I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you're listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are answering your questions about Cormac McCarthy's The Road. That's right. It's time for a Q&A. It's time to dig into some of your thoughts, some of your questions. You may be noticing that, unlike the last few episodes, our guy Sean is not here. He did not pop in and say, "I'm Sean Johnson." He is. You can keep his family in your prayers. There was a death in their family, so he is with his family. So you can remember them, and we're going to do this without him. We did ask if he wanted to reschedule, and he said, "No, go ahead." He said he was sad to have missed it, and I said, "Dude, I don't think you need to apologize for anything." So just keep their family in your prayers. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing well. I just got off the road. Travel.
Nice. Not this road, though.
Not this
you
road.
You are not.
Nice.
Yeah. You know,
nicely done.
There but for the grace of God, any road
truer
could be
quotation
could be turned
could
into
not
this
be
one.
Used. Not.
Heidi, how are your roads?
Well, we have like 14 inches of snow. They're terrible. We are snowed in today.
Mid-March snow. March madness, right?
What's really crazy is that literally yesterday I was in Costa Rica with my husband and our couple friends for our 20-year anniversary. We flew back.
20 years, nice.
So we landed at like 6 p.m. here, and by 8 p.m., we pulled into the driveway at our house and it started dumping. So we went from tropical paradise to winter wonderland in 12 hours. And it's both actually been delightful.
So, Tim, how do you feel about the lack of snow that we've been getting here in the South this year? I'm
okay with it.
Disappointed.
No, I'm okay with it. I mean, it's nice. It's nice to get that like once a year dusting, and to have everybody screaming about running out of bread at the grocery store. But
yeah.
The COVID flashbacks.
Yeah, right.
Well, down here before if
the toilet paper surge.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Indeed.
It's weird that you mentioned that because it's mid-March. It's March 14th when we're recording this, and that makes it 4 years ago this month that all that went down.
No way.
And I was thinking about driving around with my then one-year-old daughter. She's now five, driving around in a car trying to get her to nap and listening to podcasts about what was going on in the world and how the NBA was shutting down. Just like, I have these weird, vivid memories of that. And now, Tim, she's five, and you have a daughter that is that age.
And neither one of them have a memory of COVID.
No. My daughter kind of does because something stretched on. Something stretched on, that's an interesting segue because there are some questions about the world going to, I'm just going to say going to hell because that's kind of what happens in this book. And we have a lot of, this is one of the more lengthy lists of questions we've received in a while. So that tells me that there's some thoughts that people had. So it's probably best that we do a Q&A and we'll dig into as many as we can. We are recording this at night, which is very unusual for us. And it's weird vibe, but also maybe it's appropriate. I think it's like works for talking about the road.
Because darkness covers civilization. So we
so too
have a conversation
we podcast
in the darkness.
In the darkness.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm like outside, it's just sheer black, and Heidi's got she said winter wonderland. That doesn't really call to mind the road so much, but if you imagine the snow as ash,
my son's at work and I'm worried about him driving home on the roads.
Oh yes on the roads.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about some questions. I'm not exactly sure what segue there is from that, but how about existential crisis, Heidi?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll always segue with an existential crisis.
Tied to parenting. Okay, so here's one from our friend Matt. And Matt says that, Tim, you brought up the notion of an existential, quote, leap of faith, that a life lived in a hope that God exists demonstrates its own validity. I'm wondering if McCarthy occupies some space between the Christian vision of suffering / hope in, say, Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, and the sort of meaninglessness, in, say, Beckett or Kafka. So there's that question. So do you see him as kind of occupying that middle space? And then also, what works would pair well with the road to explore these crises of faith matters a little more? Tim, I'll turn that over to you first.
I don't know that he, I'll say he occupies the middle space if you grant me that he kind of alternately holds one position and then the other position. And I remember seeing an interview with Cormac McCarthy. As a matter of fact, it was the Oprah interview, I think, in which she said, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, I think his answer was something like, "On Monday, yes. On Tuesday, no." And I kind of see that, it's not ambivalence, that's not the right word, but that kind of tension in his writings. The last two books, it shows up pretty brightly. It shows up in this book. Although this book might be among the most, that might be the most hopeful of his books. So yeah, I think he occupies a middle space. Okay, so what books?
What works would pair well along the lines of that crises of faith?
Like a wine pairing.
Yeah.
The existential leap of faith, you know, that a life lived in hope that God exists demonstrates its own validity. So are there other books that factor into that or relate to that topic?
I mean, this is Kierkegaard kind of straight up with no chaser. And so I would recommend something like Fear and Trembling. I mean, get ready to get into the deep end if you read Fear and Trembling, or maybe something like, The Present Age is a shorter book that he wrote, and I think that might be kind of a good introduction. There's a book that's kind of hard to find that I think I've recommended on this show before called Four Modern Moralists, and Kierkegaard is among them, Dostoevsky is among them. I think that's it's a really, really smart, insightful book. And it kind of it's about existentialism in 19th and 20th century novelists by an author named Paul Ramsey. I wish that book was more popular. I just found it to be so illuminating, but it's kind of fallen by the wayside, just unfortunately by neglect.
I like the kind of concept of the question. Do you have any, what would you pair with The Road?
Yeah, I think that The Road pairs well with The Russians, for sure. Cormac McCarthy pairs very well with The Russians. Not exactly the same, but pairs well, right? Like they accompany each other. They ask similar questions. They are able to dwell in human suffering without giving up on the concept of human morality, which I think the modern novel has pretty much completely. And so I think if you're looking for more Western fiction, I think Cormac McCarthy pairs well with The Lost Generation, because I'm talking about Hemingway and Fitzgerald, because they have the same preoccupation with kind of a desire for a moral center without knowing where to put your weight down on it, in the absence of conventional Christianity. And so I would say that in terms of fiction, if you're wanting to kind of read in the same existential dilemmas, those would be my recommendations. And I think that might be why we and others, especially Christians, really can resonate with McCarthy more than some other modern novelists, contemporary novelists, because he wants there to be goodness. Like his books have this depth, like this lament to them. Even when he can't believe, he is mourning that, whereas more nihilistic authors just kind of say, okay, fine, like there is no good and evil, there is only power. And you know, those afraid to use it, which is a quote from Voldemort. And that theme is explored ad nauseum in modern novels, so much so that it's getting so insignificant and boring. And so I think that Cormac McCarthy tends to remind us, even those who don't share his spiritual conflict, just how the human longing for a moral trajectory never leaves Cormac McCarthy's books, even when he comes to a conclusion that we can't follow him into in other novels.
So what do you think of the moviegoer or
mm-hmm.
which is a very different sort of
yeah.
experience.
I think so.
Like a lot of existentialist questions.
The Catholic novelist of the mid 20th century would be another, you know, well chosen pairing to Cormac McCarthy.
I just think I would say yes to Walker Percy. I would say no to The Moviegoer. I just don't think it's a great book, but I think like all of his other books are better than The Moviegoer. Even that's the one that won the National Book Prize. I digress.
Yeah.
I think Walker Percy would be a good pairing.
Graham Greene.
Yeah.
Evil and Waugh. Mm.
Green. Yeah. The Green, especially that hits, you know,
mm-hmm.
my brain immediately started, you know, flickering green lights on that one. Let's do this one, another one from Matt, because it's something we've talked about a bunch, and I think it's a good way for us to focus on something that we've, or expound on something we've referenced a bunch. He says, this is a bit of a craft question. McCarthy's excellence at dialogue was mentioned several times. Could you elaborate on what it is specifically that makes it so? Is it the quick, short exchanges, the general lack of attributions, or even the verbatim repetitions in the conversations, such as when the boy asks, are we the good guys? And the father says, yes, we are the good guys. And then the boy would say, okay. And the father would say, okay. Etc., says Matt. Heidi, what do you think? What makes his dialogue work?
I don't know that I've ever done this before. I am not going to answer this. I'm going to pass this back to you because it was you who made this assertion. And this is a question such as you love. So I refuse to answer till you answer.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to turn it over to the playwright to give some comments on dialogue. And then I will jump in because I do have thoughts on this, but I would love to hear what the playwright says. And then once I've answered, then Heidi, then you can stick with your own.
I'll follow up.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I think the things that are listed, like not having attributions, not having quote marks, the repetition, I would call those characteristics or kind of style choices. I don't know that I would call those evidences of excellence. I think what makes him an excellent dialogue writer is how much he conveys with so little. Mm-hmm. And I would say that he conveys so much with so little because he writes brilliantly with subtext. Subtext is always, mm-hmm. Many of you know that I'm a Shakespeare fan, and there's kind of a saying among actors that there's no subtext in Shakespeare. Like Shakespeare just has his characters say what they mean. There is some subtext, but the point is made. But I think part of what makes great dialogue writers really great is that human beings communicate in subtext all the time. It's kind of our major, it's kind of our preferred method of communication. You know, my wife and I are having a conversation in the kitchen about finances. It's kind of about finances. It's kind of about, it's maybe a little bit more about our relationship. That's the subtext, you know. I think McCarthy's a total master at that.
I think there is good narrative dialogue has the subtext, as you're saying, and it also has to feel both real and surprising at the same time. And I think one of the things that McCarthy does is most of the conversations feel like the way people actually speak, especially when they're in intense situations. He does really well with writing dialogue of characters who are under pressure or in some very intense situation. I mean, read All the Pretty Horses, and it's all throughout there. But he also does dialogue really well among people who are wondering about stuff, like grasping for something. And in both cases, he can make it seem like the way that people would really speak. A lot of novels you read and it's like, yeah, I know that you're making people speak, but most people aren't actually going to say words that way. Like they don't create sentences that way on the fly. And he can make people speak in ways that people actually speak. But then every now and then he'll drop someone in who will say something surprising, who will drop, could be some kind of wisdom, will drop a question, could be something, you know, about a prophet, say. or he'll drop some idea into it through the dialogue that's spoken in a way that people actually do speak, in the mode that people actually speak, but introduces some kind of new or surprising idea, but it's done in a way that kind of reinforces the subtext, not throwing some new idea in there for the sake of being interesting or redirecting the story, but it's because it like reinforces the subtext Tim's talking about. And I think that there's a fine line of doing that really well. And when you're reading a narrative or you're listening to a play, you don't want it to only be how people actually speak. You want to sometimes feel like I'm reading someone creating a dramatic moment. And so you want it to be a balance of those two things, which very few people are good at. So that's what I would just add to Tim's comment about subtext. Now Heidi has to talk because we both spoke.
Yeah, I think as a novelist, I just love everything you're saying. And I'm going to say more about the effect of it on me as a reader. And that is that I think that other than Ernest Hemingway, I've never read an author who can awaken so much pathos in me and like desire for the good of the characters in an impossible situation. And so much grief on their behalf with so few words. It's Cormac McCarthy and Ernest Hemingway by a mile, that just short sentences, all the things that you said that are style, Tim, both Hemingway and McCarthy do that. But they have this like wallop of emotional weight that I think is unparalleled. I don't know. And I think you guys are kind of getting to how he does it, but to me, it's just like magic.
And one of the effects of all that subtext is it makes you as a reader work harder. Who's speaking? Wait, what are they talking about? They're not talking about, they're not talking about the knapsack. They're talking about something else. And so it forces you to work harder. And the harder you work, the more imaginative construction you apply to the text and the more immersed you become in the text. I think Hemingway's a perfect kind of like side by side. I don't know if it's a perfect pairing. They might be too close to be a perfect pairing. It's like, I don't know, help me here. A Chardonnay and a Riesling.
Yeah.
It's like,
you don't need all that.
Yeah.
That's too much.
Yeah.
You don't want to read them right next to each other.
Yeah, it depends on why you're reading them, I suppose. Because I regularly do that. Here's one from Rachel. Rachel, she wants to know, would you watch the movie after reading this book? I noticed it had been made in 2009, but personally, I am not interested in it. I feel like I already watched it in my head through reading. Have either of you seen this movie?
I saw it, and I think it's fine. It's not a bad movie. It was not good either. Like, but if you made me say why it wasn't good, I don't know that I really could choose. Like, it was well acted. You know, the plot from the book is riveting and they import it pretty squarely into the movie. It might just be, it's just kind of hard to translate this book into a movie. That's a cop out. That's like what everybody says. But in this case, it might be true.
So I just wouldn't want to see it. Like I can barely imagine it. For me, it's all just like an emotional response. Like I wouldn't want to see it because it's, like the images are so, just so intense that I wouldn't want to see it on a screen.
Yeah,
I think
right.
Viggo Mortensen is like the greatest choice ever for the father, though. I think like that just seems like a perfect casting choice. Well done, I applaud you for it. But I'm not interested, and it's not like because I don't want the images in my head. It's not like I'm not necessarily on a moral decision. It's more like an emotional one. Like that's just too much. That would just be too much for me. I wouldn't want to do it. Or else it would, if it wasn't too much, it would just be a cheap version. And I wouldn't want that either. I wouldn't want it to fall short of the emotional weight of the novel either. Like if it looked fake or if it wasn't hard enough, So either way, I just don't want to see it. I'd rather read it.
Great cast. Great. Mm-hmm. John Hillcoat is an incredible.
Did you like it, David?
I never watched it.
Why not?
I don't know. Just never did. Graham liked it, I think. I just...
And Graham loves The Road. We have to say this to our audience. He loves this book so much. So if he liked it, that's actually compelling.
Yeah, I don't know that... I think he probably feels the way Tim did. Like he thought it was pretty good, but I don't know that you can really get. Yeah. I don't know if you can get at what makes the road better than other post-apocalyptic stories in a movie. I think it's so particular to the form. Because, you know, I don't know, how do you get into the soul of the book in a movie? In the, you know, I don't, unless it's like, you know, I guess they said that about The Heart of Darkness too, though. And now we have Apocalypse Now. So, but no, I was wondering if I would watch it. But unlike you, Heidi, I actually don't like Viggo Mortensen. So that's that. Maybe that was why I never watched it. Because I love John Hillcoat, but I never watched, not a Viggo Mortensen guy. I'm one of the few people who thinks he's bad Aragorn. I mean, he's not bad. I just don't think that he's.
He was best. The right casting choice in your mind. Yeah.
Let's do this one. So Melanie asks, as I was rereading the end of the novel today, this line struck out to me. "Look around you," he said. "There is no prophet in the earth's long chronicle who's not honored here today. Whatever form you spoke of, you were right." End quote. Melanie says, "I have no idea what this means, but it feels important as it's one of the last things the father says to his son. Help." So there's a few passages like this that people ask for some clarity on or our thoughts on.
Could you read the quote again?
I'll read it. I'll read it one more time. He says, "Look around you." So the full quote is, "Look around you," he said. "There is no prophet in the earth's long chronicle who is not honored here today. Whatever form you spoke of, you were right." So for those of you who have a book handy, this is on page 277. And it's right after the part where they start to move inland. And it says this. So I'll read a little bit more than what that quote was. "He watched him come through the grass and kneel with the cup of water he'd fetched. There was light all about him. He took the cup and drank and lay back. They had food. They had for food a single tin of peaches, but he made the boy eat it and he wouldn't take any. 'I can't,' he said. 'It's all right. I'll save your half.' 'Okay, you save it until tomorrow.' He took the cup and moved away, and when he moved, the light moved with him. He'd wanted to try and make a tent out of the tarp, but the man would not let him. He said that he didn't want anything covering him. He lay watching the boy at the fire. He wanted to be able to see. 'Look around you,' he said. 'There is no prophet in the earth's long chronicle who is not honored here today. Whatever form you spoke of, you were right.'" And then there's a section break there. There's definitely some communion type imagery going on there, allusions, it seems like. What do you think, Heidi?
Yeah, I think that this is a very complex meeting of potential interpretations and ideas within the novel. One is very hopeful, right? Like there's a reference to messianic prophecies, which have been in every religious and cultural tradition from the beginning of time. There is coming somebody who is going to carry the fire, right? Somebody who's going to keep the faith and provide hope for the future and restore all things. And of course, all of those are either overt references to Christ or shadows that are found in other stories and fulfilled in Christ. And so there's that kind of messianic idea of a carrying on, a keeping of the faith. And the boy is that, right? As far as the man knows, he is the child, like he is the chosen one. He is the grail. And the father has succeeded, right? In keeping him alive to go forward. And so there's that. On the other hand, we have our nihilistic quote of there, you know, there is no God and we are his prophets. And that could be equally fulfilled in the father's death because now the son is unprotected, right? And but he says then all of these prophecies are fulfilled in the boy. And so it has, I think, a hopeful meaning and a hopeless meaning and just an ambiguity that is characteristic of the novel that gives it to us as readers to interpret as the book becomes a mirror for us to wrestle with our own preoccupations and conceptions of hope.
The prophets are, there's kind, even though they speak with very diverse voices, there's kind of a pattern to almost all of the Old Testament prophets. Like outside of the Old Testament, there's some variety. But the prophets are not just foreseeing the future. It's they rarely speak with like foreknowledge that's really clear. It's more, there has been an infraction. The covenant between God and man has been broken. These are the penalties or potential penalties. And here is something on the far side of that, a great signal of hope. And I think like what we see through the father's eyes toward the boy captures all of those things. I mean, I think the whole desolation of the planet is an infraction, a deep infraction of some kind. However the world blew up, it's not as it should be. Here is this single figure, this boy, who kind of is like untabernacled. Like he won't put the tent, he doesn't want the tent over him. He's untabernacled. He's revealed as both someone who's suffering because of this, but also of a hope that that is beyond this kind of scorched earth. So that's how I would read that. It's funny, when I hear the quote, it clearly says, he said, and it sure seems like he said it to the boy. But man, when I think back about this passage, I think I read it in my mind as this is a little bit more reflective and internal than it is spoken externally. Because the father does not speak to the boy on any occasion like this, which makes me think, I mean, like, is this spoken aloud or is this spoken to himself? I would almost vote maybe against the evidence of the text that this is internally spoken, but I could be argued out of that kind of easily. I don't think it matters. I don't think the meaning changes whether or not it's spoken, you know, audibly or just spoken in his mind. I think the meaning remains the same.
One of the things that makes this book so powerful is, and we talked about this before, is the fact that it functions on this kind of mythopoeic level, right? This very spiritual, cosmological, allegorical level that is the human condition played out in the road. And it has this convergence of multiple traditions along with the author's kind of cry for meaning that really he just leaves out there in all of his books. And also along with that, and this is why this particular book I think is just so powerful, is that that's literally true within the world of the novel. Like it is literally true within the world of the novel that the only, so far, we're about to meet another we're about to meet more moral characters, but so far in the novel, the only person who has any kind of ethic of charity to a neighbor, not just his own. You know, the father has this ethic of protection of his own, which is not less moral. But the boy has an ethic of charity towards his neighbor. And so it is literally true in the world of the novel that this boy so far is the only beacon of hope to maintain a moral center for the whole planet that we know of. The only one with potential to carry the fire with the father's death. And that makes that conversation all the more weighty because it's not just some kind of abstract philosophical or religious speculation. It's not a declaration on a metaphysical level. It's not conceptual. It's real.
These lines come right after he realizes this is where he's going to die.
Right.
And, he says he knew he could go no further and this was the place he would die. The boy sat watching him, his eyes welling. And it's fascinating to me that he doesn't want to be covered. Despite the way the world looks, he still wants to see it. He wants to be able to look out. He wants to take it all in. And it mentions that where they stop, there's a, or where they head inland anyway, there's a vast low swale where ferns and hydrangeas and wild orchids live on in ashen effigies, which the wind had not yet reached, which is a pretty fascinating image. and it speaks to something that's lost, you know, what once was. And it's as if he's looking back at what once was here at the end. But we have to move on now because that's how Q&As work. So does either of you want to add anything else to this? Okay. So here's one. Tim, I'd love to hear from you on this one. Thomas says, I love this book. It's my fifth reread. The convenience of the man and his son problems being abruptly solved is a huge distraction for me. So example, the man and his son are on the brink of starvation and conveniently find a doomsday prepper's underground cavern of food, drink, and luxury. Is the convenience a distraction? Or is it McCarthy deliberately pointing the reader to the hope he wants us to find in the novel?
It is not a distraction for me. I mean, I get it. Like, I don't know, kitchen from the machine could be like the underground, you know, discovery of the underground cans of food. I get that. If you wanted to look at it sideways, you'd be like, wow, really convenient. They were starving and they discovered all this, you know, a hoarder's, well, not a hoarder's, but a, like, you know, somebody who was afraid of.
Someone who prepared.
Yeah. Somebody who prepared. I don't know. It did not bother me. And I think that being taken to the edge, very edge of starvation only enhances the book. So that's a pretty emotional response. It's like, I didn't bother me. Next. That's probably sound a little bit flippant. I don't mean to sound flippant. Heidi, you've got a better answer than me.
No, I really don't. I mean, the only way to have a story is to have intervention on the part of an author at strategic points to make the story, right? So this whole narrative is unrealistic, air quotes. And so a story about hope that contemplates the concept of hope has to have moments of hope and meaning in it. It just has to, or else it's a really short story and an unenduring story. So I think that, is it realistic that people stumble upon, you know, hordes of food buried underground? No, but it's also not realistic that they stumble upon people being kept underground to be harvested as food by having their limbs sawed off. That's equally unrealistic. So I think that we just have to accept the world of the story that has these moments of like extreme suffering that we seem somehow able to accept as more realistic than the moments of hope. And I think that that's one of the questions that the book even is conscious of raising. Is that exact one? Why do we accept despair before we accept hope?
The father acknowledges the problem. I mean, he keeps saying we've been lucky, and he knows like that they're alive because they've when they needed it, they stumbled upon it. And in some ways, I do think that's McCarthy acknowledging the problem that Thomas is mentioning here. I'm very aware of it when I read the book, but I also think that the introduction of the concept of luck in a story about hope is also interesting. Like, we could have a whole discussion about what is luck in this book.
I agree with that, and I think that's true. But I also think one of the questions the book is raising is, what if it isn't luck? What if there is an intervening grace? Mm-hmm. What if there is a God saving these people by bringing them food and giving him a family at the last impossible second?
I think that's exactly right.
And so I think that the moments of hope are absolutely necessary. And because the stark reality of the land, it isn't just to relieve the tension on a dramatic sense. It isn't. It's to raise the question of meaning.
And that's such a great answer, Heidi. And on top of that, I think the only way you can see the kind of possibility that it was a grace that showed them the potatoes buried in the field, that helped them discover the underground pantry, the only way you can see that is sort of retroactively. Because in the moment, it just feels like blind luck. But you get to the end of the book and you're like, oh my gosh, these glimmers of grace have really coalesced now around this boy being discovered by this family. Maybe these other moments too were moments of like preserving grace. And to quote Kierkegaard, since he's already shown up once, like one of his best known quotes, life can only be lived forward, but can only be understood backwards. You know, it's only by looking back at events do you understand like the meaning of them, the role that they played in your life. When you're in the thick of it, it's sometimes really hard to understand like what exactly is going on. What does this mean for my life?
Tim, if you had to make a Mount Rushmore of Tim McIntosh patron saints, like literary patron saints, yeah, would Kierkegaard be on that Mount Rushmore for you?
Oh man, I'd have to think about that one. Probably just because of the amount of time that I've spent with him. Like, I think being my age now, he doesn't quite resonate the way that he did when he was, when I was 28 years old. But I've still spent so much time with him, and he's been so instructive in my life that he probably would still be in Mount Rushmore for me. Oh,
he's just over here, like on the right side, like up against the, you know, like a little smaller.
Like in the Teddy Roosevelt spot. You're like, Teddy Roosevelt, right. Great president. Did he belong on Mount Rushmore? Hot take. Maybe not.
Well, he's probably on it because of the whole national parks thing or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. I was
like, he probably put himself up there. Hey, Heidi, here's one from Trisha. In the last episode, you said regarding the ending, and she's paraphrasing here, McCarthy left the ending ambiguous as all great novelists do. I understand, says Trisha, the value of leaving room for interpretation, not having to tidy everything up in a bow, etc. But what's wrong with some unambiguous hope? Would he not be a great novelist if the fish are real? Is this a modern sensibility that the ending of novels are only great if they're ambiguous? Or do you believe artistically most novels are objectively better when endings like this leave is so much open to interpretation?
That's a really good question. And I'd have to probably cycle back from the statement that all great novels end in ambiguity. I guess I don't think that's true, especially since I came out really hot on mystery novels need to have all of their neat little bows tied up. And I came out swinging on that and I stand by it.
Okay, let's do an experiment though. Like, what's a great novel that ends with unambiguously?
So now I'm thinking about that. I think, hold on though, and I will ponder that while I am talking. Or you two both can too. I do think that this novel absolutely must end ambiguously. I think if it took a stand on hopelessness or on meaninglessness or on just complete salvation, I think that it would diminish the book and we wouldn't even be reading it. That would be too... That wouldn't work. A great novel that ends unambiguously is Lord of the Rings. Although I don't know if it does, actually. It's a bit ambiguous at the end. Or
there's so much going on and there's multiple endings.
Right.
But like but, in the even after Scouring of the Shire, there's ambiguity there, I think.
But ambiguity is a little bit different from a sense of lament, right? But like Frodo has to end with his unhealed wound. He can't be completely reconciled to the Shire. Like that, I don't know if that's ambiguous though, as much as it is just letting the world remain a fallen place with room for more stories. But I do think they're, so I am going to cycle back from saying all, but I'm going to say most, and that probably the ones that linger for us do.
Tim, oh yeah.
What about Brothers Karamazov as an unambiguous ending?
No, I think it is ambiguous. You
think it is? I think there's too many characters at least for whom there's an ambiguity.
Because you really don't know about Mitya. You don't know about Dmitri. Yeah. Like there's, but I think that it's unambiguous. If I could, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, Tim, but it seems to me that the trajectory of each character breaks off at not only a satisfying, but a right, like a point of restoration and redemption that gives us hope for the character without telling us everything ends perfectly and lets them still remain fallen and not fixed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think we'd have to do a little bit of definition. Like we could have a really interesting conversation on this question if we, you know, like, and take more time on it, and we'd have to do some definition on the word ambiguous. But Trisha you know, follows, mm-hmm. She ends this question by saying, do you believe artistically most novels are objectively better when endings like this leave so much open to interpretation? And that's it. If she seems to be defining and maybe correlating ambiguity with leaving things open for interpretation, and that, you know, you could have a book that has a, where the moral order or the moral structure of the world of the novel is unambiguous, and you could still have the
like Lord
result.
Of the Rings.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, we know what there's a distinct moral order in that book, and yet there are still things that one can spend time thinking about and ask questions about for the rest of your life. I probably would say that any great work of art, by the nature of being a work of art, leaves itself open to variety of interpretations. But mm-hmm. we could, like, I mean, if you think about the greatest paintings, they're one thing on the surface, and the more time you spend looking at them, they become something else, and they open themselves up to new levels, new layers of interpretation. And we talk about that all the time. Like, another novels often are one thing on the surface, and then we talk about them, and all of a sudden we're like, wow, I never thought about that before. It's a new way of thinking about it. And that's, I think, one of the defining characteristics of great art. Tim, you just put the mic to your mouth.
Maybe the analogy is great works of art are great because of their depth. Mm-hmm. And if something has great depth, it's really hard to see all the way to the bottom. Mm-hmm. If something is shallow, yeah, you can see to the bottom. And so, yeah, what we're calling ambiguity maybe is just a sort of like opacity caused by depth.
I think that's good. Much like one of Tim's favorite works from last year, The Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Exactly, Heidi. I mean, the richness therein.
Yeah,
the complications.
Like, you know why he's eating?
Yes.
He's so hungry because he's about to go into a metaphorical death and emerge.
What does it
transformed mean?
Yes, what does it mean?
There you go.
Great callback,
Trisha.
I believe this is time for me to ask another question. this is when there should be a transition, and I'm drawing a blank, perhaps because it's 10 p.m. Okay, I do want to bring this up. There was two questions related to A Canticle for Leibowitz, which I thought was interesting. And Aaron says, since you so recently did A Canticle for Leibowitz on the show, I couldn't help but make a comparison of the two books' treatment of assisted suicide, euthanasia, and the relationship of those things in getting out of a post-apocalyptic world. There are a lot of similarities in the two, but the writers are different, and I think The Road is ultimately a more captivating treatment of the subject. I'd like to hear you guys talk about them in juxtaposition. Now, there's another question about this that I want to introduce to this conversation, and maybe kind of we can even focus on it a little bit because we're just talking about comparing the two. Mark, would you consider The Road or Canticle for Leibowitz more hopeful? What is the most hopeful book you have read? The Bible not included. We can come to that in a second. But a little Canticle, The Road comparison here. Any thoughts on this, Heidi?
I think Canticle for Leibowitz is definitely more hopeful. I think that the comparison between the two is apt because they're both raising the question of not only what would happen to the world if we had an apocalyptic event, which that's a pretty common question in dystopian novels, right? But what would happen to the moral order as represented by individual characters in the event of an apocalyptic event? And I think that Canticle for Leibowitz remains more hopeful because there is a carrying on across multiple generations as a cyclical nature of reality, whereas Cormac McCarthy's The Road is one big devastating event that is the end. And we don't see a return. I think we see hints of a potential return, but we certainly don't see a unequivocal belief in a return on or a renewal on the earth. So I think Canticle is more hopeful.
Tim, do you have any thoughts on this?
This is a hard question. I'm going to say The Road. And my criteria for saying that.
I'm so glad you are. We can't both agree on this. We need to have a.
I was going
to
say The Road. I think I agree with The Road too.
For me, it's because of the size of the obstacle in the road is just incredibly large, and just surviving is such a triumph. I think that's part of the reason why I would vote that way. What about you, David? You said the road. What are your criteria?
I Canticle, I don't know that I come away from that feeling like I was inspired or anything. I don't know. It's weird to say that because in some ways it feels, it's so cyclical. You know, it's like it ends where it starts and the world's going to go through these things again. And that feels, I mean, it's both hopeful that someone will come every time something bad happens, we can rise out of it, but also something bad's going to happen again. And I feel like when I get to the end of the road, I feel more, it's more deliberately hopeful, but also maybe he is fighting for the hope himself, McCarthy is. And that rings really, well, I was going to say rings really true for me, but I don't want you to think that I'm going through something. But then, whereas it feels like in some ways, Canticle, he's trying, he's out there to write something hopeful, and that doesn't hit me over the head with the hope as much as the road does. Like the road's so bleak that, to Tim's point, that when you get to the end and there's this sprinkling of hope, it's like water and when you've been parched. So I think I would say that. Do you guys have thoughts on what's the most hopeful book you've ever read? That's what Mark asked. Other than the Bible.
Hamlet? Should we narrow that down to like a novel, like fiction?
Why are you gonna say the Odyssey otherwise?
No, I would include that. I mean, I guess I just mean like a book of nonfiction that kind of
expounds instead of
explores.
Yeah, right.
So I'm going to confine my answer to fiction. And I really think it's Lord of the Rings.
It would be very high. It's on the Mount Rushmore of hope books.
Yeah.
That's a great choice.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I'm going to choose from Shakespeare. The Winter's Tale, one of maybe the last four plays that he wrote. What a wonderful play. And it's so hopeful. And part of the reason that it's so hopeful is a little bit like Frodo suffers. His injury does not go away just because Mordor is destroyed, the ring is destroyed. His injury remains with him. And I see that in The Winter's Tale. Like, it's a tremendously redemptive turn, but the injuries that are done remain, and yet they're overcome. And I just find that so human and humane.
Do you guys find The Very Hungry Caterpillar hopeful?
I do. Yeah. I do. The moment that the hungry caterpillar goes through the core of the apple, right when we think he can't get there from here, and yet he does.
Preach, brother. No, really, keep going.
It's got to be on the Mount Rushmore of hope books.
Do you guys find Crime and Punishment hopeful?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, for sure. But I wouldn't put it on my Mount Rushmore of most hopeful.
Yeah, yeah.
You mean the book that ends in a Siberian death camp, you don't find it hopeful? It's not a death camp, but
it sounded good when I was saying it.
Yeah, no, I think that you shouldn't have pedaled back from that. You should have just let that stand.
You know what I think is hopeful is Brideshead Revisited.
Yeah.
But, you know, hope is a thing with feathers.
It's the thing with feathers.
Okay, here's one from Sarah, which is something I've been thinking about a lot. So she says, there are a few comments throughout the book that allude to what caused the post-apocalyptic landscape our characters encounter. I'd love to hear more about what people think happened, and does your answer to that affect how you read the story or create another lens to process it through? Would you have liked a more obvious cause, or does the uncertainty add to the atmosphere of the book? Do you guys have thoughts on what happened? I think I don't have any thoughts on what happened. I mean, I've read so many post-apocalyptic books, they all have their own like version of that. But the last couple of questions there, I think, are worth discussing. Like, does not knowing affect how you read it? And do you actually want to know more? Like, do you think it would have done anything more for you to know what the cause was? Heidi, what do you got?
I don't think it would have changed the book. I think whenever you don't have to explain something in a novel like this, whenever you don't have to explain something, you shouldn't. And I think with, for example, with Canticle for Leibowitz, the whole point of Canticle for Leibowitz is that it's a nuclear disaster. And the road, I guess I assumed that. I assumed it's the result of human violence and carelessness with you. I assumed we destroyed ourselves in the road. And I guess I think that is pretty important, like that it's not just like an alien attack or something like that, but a cataclysm that didn't need to happen. Not like a solar flare or something, but Cormac McCarthy actually doesn't make that clear. So I guess it doesn't matter. But to me, it adds more pathos to the if we destroy ourselves. But what that event is doesn't really matter to me.
I would even argue that if we did know, it would be a distraction from the book's quality. Because we can imagine if it's like a Chernobyl-like nuclear Holocaust, then we're like, oh man, the guys that screwed that up didn't follow protocols or whatever it is. And they become kind of like a focus point for the hellscape that the earth becomes. If it's nuclear war, we point at the politicians, oh man, those guys, they couldn't help themselves but press the button, and they become the focal point of the hellscape. Not knowing, I think, is crucial to like focusing our mind on the world that now is.
And it makes it scarier. Like anytime it you does, don't know something, it's scarier to you. It's harder to orient yourselves. There's no solution because you don't even know the cause, right? Like that is, I do think it's very important for the dramatic tension of the story as well as for kind of the underlying contemplations of the story.
Yeah, it makes it more universal too.
Yeah.
You know, in 100 years,
fill it in with your own fears.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or whatever's in 200 years or 1,000 years, someone could still read this book and whatever thing is potentially plaguing that you know, era could be the thing that you have in your head. You know, reading it now, you know, after COVID with, you know, you could easily imagine it as being something related to some kind of disease that then descended into violence and, you know, things fall apart. The thing is, it makes you realize that you pull a few threads and things just tumble, right? And so I think it actually adds, the dramatic stakes, I think, are heightened by not knowing. There's a question here about a specific passage I want to touch on before we do a couple more. I'd like to just end with a couple quick ones. So Alex asks about a perspective change on page 87. And the paragraph starts I'll just read the whole paragraph, but Alex says, what's the deal with that? Why does it shift from third person to first person, basically with the man speaking to us instead of the narrator? McCarthy must have meant something by it, and it's not by accident. I can't think of why. What do you guys think? Only paragraph in the whole book that is in first person. So this is what it says. So they make a camp, and they eat...
What page is this on, David?
87. So it says they ate each of them two of the cornmeal cakes, and they slept together huddled on the ground in the coats and blankets. He held the child, and after a while, the child stopped shivering, and after a while, he slept. And then this paragraph. The dog that he remembers followed us for 2 days. I tried to coax it to come, but it would not. I made a noose of wire to catch it. There were 3 cartridges in the pistol, none to spare. She walked away down the road. The boy looked after her, and then he looked at me, and then he looked at the dog, and he began to cry and to beg for the dog's life, and I promised I would not hurt the dog. A trellis of a dog with the hide stretched over it. The next day, it was gone. That is the dog he remembers. He doesn't remember any little boys. And this is right after he's seen the boy that he's worried about. Thoughts on this perspective change? It's an interesting choice, so it's worth addressing. Heidi?
I assumed it was a dream.
So the narrator's not talking to us then. He's talking to somebody else in a dream.
I guess so. Or remembering a dream or narrate. I just assumed that, I guess, because it was so stark to me. The other option is less appealing to me, which is that I mean, there's a couple other options. Another option that's much less appealing to me is that McCarthy intended to kind of use that narrative voice to switch between them throughout the novel and then only did it once.
As much as like possible. That. Then he messed, I mean, then an,
yeah,
an
and then like forgot
have.
Or didn't, ed- yeah. or like an editor missed
by the
it or something.
Too. Oh my gosh, reprint, stop the presses. That
yeah,
seems pretty unlikely.
And I don't really like that option, but I suppose it's valid. Or and the other option is that this is somehow super important to the meaning of the novel and it is intended to stand out and it has some kind of like very intense depth of meaning to it that we're just missing or I didn't circle back to. I don't know. What do you guys think? That's my least appealing of all.
We talked last week that sometimes McCarthy will slip into the present tense
yeah.
and then back into past tense with like no real explanation, but I think it has an effect upon the reader. Mm. I find it hard to explain what the effect is when I'm reading it, but it like sinks me further into the narrative. And so why does he do it? I think about this essay that Tolstoy wrote about the genre of War and Peace. If you've never read War and Peace, it's a historical, it's a fictional story that is populated by real characters like Napoleon, and it's interrupted by Tolstoy just talking about his philosophy of history for 40 pages. And so people would read the book and they'd be like, what genre is this? So Tolstoy wrote an essay in for like the Moscow Times, whatever it was. And he said the essay, that the genre is a genre developed by the author himself because it suited my purposes and because it pleased me to do so. And I kind of wonder if that's what's going on in this sentence. Like it works. The paragraph works.
That's true.
It breaks these rules. And maybe it just like he did it because he knew that it worked and it pleased him to do so.
Well, it comes in the heels too of them like debating about whether the boy that the son sees is real. Because
right.
The boy says he sees someone, but the father says there's no one there. We got to go. You're going to die. And so at first you're like, oh, the father's just telling him that so he'll come with him. But then he mentions that the boy had a dog, that the dog could go chase something to eat. So I think he's trying to potentially, he's as maybe at minimum, just trying to create some disorientation to get us to figure out what's real and what's not.
Maybe.
It also could be that he's speaking out loud. The boy's asleep and he's, you know, he's remembering.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
And that speaks to the dreamscape. But I think it's early enough in the book that he's trying to occasionally reorient and disorient us.
Yeah.
But it's a good observation.
Maybe.
So all that to say, yeah. We don't know.
Yeah.
But just linger in that, man. Just have fun with it, right?
That's right. Like,
just sit in it. Just sit in it, man.
That's right.
Just let it wash over you.
Just like hotbox it.
Nice.
Just hotbox it.
Okay. Okay, I know we got to go. Let's... Stephanie asks on this thread, I'm sure I'm not the only one wondering, will there be a Close Reads March Madness literary bracket this year? And the answer is there will be. By the time this is up, it'll be posted tomorrow and it's going to be about the best first lines in literature. So be on the lookout for that. Let's do one more and then I want to two more. The last one shouldn't take long. All right, here, let's do this one from Astrid, I think. She has a question about the man's personal faith or lack thereof. On page 68, he tells the boy, my job is to take care of you. I was appointed to do that by God. I will kill anyone who touches you. Do you understand? Given what y'all discussed on the podcast about the boy being the grail, do you think the father truly believes this statement? Does he wish it to be true or is he simply making up a story? And if he's lying, why? So does he believe it when he says that he's appointed to do that by God? Given the questions we've talked about his faith. Heidi, what you got?
I don't know. I think that he tells the boy stories of goodness and valor and nobility, because he wants the boy to have a moral scaffolding. And so I think in this case, it seems to me that he says it for the sake of the boy's belief in order to bolster the boy's hope. It's very clear throughout the novel that he is not a Christian, the man, the father is. But I think he's probably faced, well, he's definitely faced with deeper, a greater depth of spiritual crisis than we are. And so he struggles with the reality of God throughout the novel overtly. And so, no, I don't think that this is a statement of personal faith, but I think that he wants the boy to believe it. And that is compelling to me.
I think that he's very clear in his belief that the boy is special,
right?
Set apart, like the Word of God, the carrier of the flame.
The Grail.
I think what he's unsure about is who he is. You know, like, I'm his dad, I'm his protector. And so, like, I'm with you, Heidi, like the statement, like, you know, God me put me here to protect you, or whatever the line is. I'm not sure that he really believes that, but he does believe that the boy is set apart in some way.
The tricky thing is that I don't know that he doesn't believe it either, though.
Exactly.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly right. Totally.
Yes, and I'm glad you said that. I don't think that McCarthy is raising questions of the man's personal faith throughout the book. I think his contemplations are far more universal than that. And I don't think it... I think it's too narrow an interpretation to try to figure out what the man believes, because he's in such a state of crisis throughout the novel that any kind of measure of hope is evidence of something deeply hard fought, embattled, and important. And that, just that, is the question.
Okay, so I got one more question for each of you. Does that work? Okay, so I'm going to do Heidi first. Heidi, Lily says, a few times throughout the book, the travelers who died on the road during the hot fires are referred to as pilgrims. I think this is especially in the graphic sections of people melted into the road or stuck in their cars, but I'm not certain since I returned the book to the library already. In what sense are we supposed to see these victims as pilgrims? Are they Pilgrim's Progress style pilgrims traveling to a better world? Or are they more medieval style pilgrims looking for a supernatural relief from their suffering, but still expecting to remain in the world? It's an interesting question. What do you think about this, the idea of the use of pilgrims to describe the various travelers throughout this book?
I think that the context of that is again, more universal than Christianity in the sense that they are looking for life, they're looking for hope, they're looking for escape. They don't seem to be on going anywhere in particular, at least we're not told that. So I think it's ambiguous. But the word pilgrim is a religious word, just as the word prophet is, right? And it is in the context of kind of this modern grail quest, like dystopian apocalyptic grail quest. And so it's kind of like this throwback to Chaucer as the question gives us like this medieval context. And there's this juxtaposition between the religious and medieval language of this novel alongside this very futuristic dystopian vision that I think dramatically creates this disorientation that's very interesting for the reader. And then on the thematic level, it continues to raise the question of whether or not there is some kind of meaning-making presence with capital P, God, that is guiding the world towards some kind of telos or ultimate end. And I think words like pilgrim and prophet make that question interesting in such a stark landscape.
They suggest the existence of something sacred?
Yes. And suggest the ambiguity of that. Like, I think we're supposed to say exactly what the question is asking. To what extent are they pilgrims, right? Are they actually going somewhere? Or does that just mean kind of we're in a pilgrimage to survive? Like, that's kind of really creepy and sad. And so mm-hmm. those, the juxtaposition of like the meaningful world of the medieval times with this dystopian modern, not just dilemma, but like crisis of survival, creates a dramatic, like a very interesting kind of multi-layered dramatic tension, as well as an adding to this whole question of hope and telos, like, is there something this is converging toward? We're on a road, but we don't know where we're going or why. And then it turns out that there is a salvation at the end of the road. But that salvation remains a query or a question mark in the mind of the reader. But I think words like that are religious aren't necessarily meaning he's trying to say that these people are religious. They are, but trying to create a framework that raises these questions for us.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tim, this is the final question. It's your final question. Elise says, well, she asks two questions, and for the sake of time, I'm just going to read the second one here. She mentions that she was surprised by how much she appreciated this book. Where should someone totally new to Cormac McCarthy go next? What of his works would you recommend trying out after the road? So we've talked about Cormac McCarthy a bit. We've did a whole episode. You could go check that out if you want to hear. Like, I think we actually talked about Mount Rushmore of Cormac McCarthy novels. But that's a different question. Like, what your favorite novels are, and even what you think the best are, is different than perhaps yeah. somebody who is, okay, you've read The Road, surprised how much you liked it. What's next? As our resident chief Cormac McCarthy enthusiast, I'm just going with that. Heidi, if you want to fight Tim for that spot, you're welcome to do that over the next decade.
I'd have you fight Tim for that spot, but Tim's a good...
No, I defer to Tim on this one. Where do you go next, Tim? What's your thoughts?
All the Pretty Horses is the next one.
Which yeah, we've done sense. Episodes on that. And so this yeah. reader seems new, and so you can go back and listen to those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And after that,
I have to go back and check which Elise it is.
After that, I might read The Crossing, which is the kind of sequel of three books following All the Pretty Horses.
Yeah. Yeah. But I wouldn't stop at The Crossing, though. You got to read The Cities of the Plain, too. You got to read the whole trilogy, in my
opinion.
Hey,
if Elise makes it through The Crossing, she'll read the last book.
That's true. I just want to say, I think that No Country for Old Men, I've said it before, I think it's in some ways a perfect novel. And it's wonderful. And if The Road was not too dark for you, too difficult to read, then No Country is a breeze. You'll be fine. But All the Pretty Horses is one of my favorite books. So I'm with Tim on that. I think that's a great choice. Tim, I just want to say, it's been great having you here.
It's been a pleasure to discuss this book that fills me with so much happiness with you too.
We're going to be doing The Hobbit next. You're going to be off. What are you going to be doing?
Another road book. A very, very different road book.
That's right. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
This is the year of Close Reads journeying. Through Close Reads on the road. Many journeys.
I remember when we were talking about which books to put in order, and Graham was like, you need to put The Road in the Hobbit. I think it was Graham that even suggested that to me. Like, you got to put them together because they're both road books, but they got different vibes. But while we're journeying along with Bilbo and co, what will you be doing? Like, what's going on in your life over the next few weeks?
This is a really busy work season. So I just got home from Colorado and then Spokane, Washington. And I think next up for me, I can't even remember. Like, I figure out where I'm going that week when I look at my schedule on Monday morning. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I'm going to California on Thursday. That's kind of how my life is right now.
Do you have your flights for you?
No, I have people that book the meetings for me. And so something will show up on my calendar, you know, in wherever, Orange County. And so I've got to book my flight. Yeah, but it's just kind of funny. You're like, yep, you're going to California next week, or you're going to Seattle.
You don't know. You're like, no, it's like next week. So sometimes you're booking flights like a couple days before.
No, that's uncommon. I shouldn't say that.
Okay.
I get an appointment put on my calendar. Mm-hmm. I have to buy the ticket, but I usually just forget.
Sure. Yeah.
Like where I'm going.
You just go wherever.
Yeah.
The calendar tells you to go. Show up to the airport. And you're
that's
like,
right.
Say I'm going
sit
to
sit at my Delta Sky Lounge.
Yeah, right. What's your
Sky
Delta
Club
points looking like right now? Like, how are you racking them up?
It's looking really nice. It's looking really nice. I'm not going to lie to you. It looks really good.
Well, we don't know exactly when you'll be back again. But when you...
For Trust. I don't know when Trust is.
Oh, that's right.
That's the next one. Is that like in a month?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I was trying to remember. Yeah, I got to look at the exact schedule. But that's right. So Tim will be back for Trust, which is going to be super fun because you are a... you texted us over... was it somewhere in the time of the fall or the winter? And you were like, hey, yeah. Guys, this Trust book... pretty fun. Have you guys read it or whatever?
Which is pretty funny. It's pretty great, Tim, because David and I have been talking about that book for like a year. And then you were like, have you guys read this?
You guys. Hey, you guys. Oh my gosh. So you were feeling, I cannot tell you how many students at Gutenberg would kind of come up to me. By the way, I don't think anybody read Cormac McCarthy before I was at Gutenberg. And then I'd have like, you know, 5 years into my career, I'd have some junior be like, you need to read McCarthy. And I'd be like,
I know.
Bro, you would not even know who he was without me.
You're basic.
Respect,
did you say that?
Respect your elders. Yeah, sit down. You're basic.
Just out of curiosity, how old were you when you were telling them to respect your elders at that point?
Yeah, I was probably like 10 years older than them.
That's fair.
Because I was a young, I was a young professor.
In 10 years.
It's true.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's
especially
true.
When, yeah.
But not so much that you were allowed to say respect your elders when you're probably only 10 years older than them. I probably shouldn't have done that.
You probably didn't even say that. Of course you didn't say that.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that, no.
Did people call people basic back then?
No, I only heard basic starting like 3 years ago.
Yeah, no, he was anticipating.
Yeah, I was anticipating.
Oh, yeah. He knew it was going to sweep the nation.
Yeah. Bit of a prophet in that regard.
Yeah, yeah, bringing it back around again.
I love that as an insult, by the way. I think it's, I love it. Oh, she was so basic.
Yeah. It's like, how many things could be worse to be told to your face by someone who you think is interesting?
Right.
Like if Tim told me that I was basic.
It would hurt. It would sting.
I'd be like, should I be, I should stop podcasting. All right. Well, Tim, it really has been great. It's so fun having you on. I know people love hearing from you and your life is very busy. So we do appreciate you when you can. I was going to say something that sounds like I'm being silly. I was going to say when you can fit us in your schedule. I don't mean that in like when you can fit us in your schedule.
Unfortunately, it's kind of like the way that it is in like this particular time of the year.
Well, though, we appreciate you making the time. I mean, we really do. So I know.
Pleasure's mine. Pleasure's mine.
I want more from Tim, though. I'll be honest. I don't appreciate it enough because I want more.
The absences are stark is what you're saying. And I'm feeling like when it's like O'Connor said about redemption, like when the darker the story is, the more I feel the redemption, the more Tim is gone, the more light he brings when he's here.
Oh, but that's nice.
But you're saying,
that feels good.
You're saying something else.
I don't want him to go. I miss him and I want him to be here.
Yeah, he's like, I need more light in my life. Yeah. Right.
Well, I'm coming back. Right. Trust is not far away.
That's true. Like,
all right.
Right.
We're taking your word for it. You see what I just did?
Yeah,
there?
We're there. Oh, nice.
Yeah, thanks. Trust. All right, well, Heidi, I do also appreciate you. Thank you for being
welcome.
Here.
You don't have to appreciate me, though. I'm here all the time. You can take me for granted.
No, that's a bad plan.
Heidi, I really take you for granted. I just want to say.
We know you do. You never show up.
And
of course, we appreciate Sean, too. As I said, keep his family in your prayers. He'll be back with us to talk about The Hobbit and continue our conversation on Kristen Lovren's daughter and for our mystery conversation. So lots going on. Appreciate all of you who are listening as well. Everybody who left a comment or left a question. I know we couldn't get to all of them. I apologize for that, but you know, it's the nature of the game. So, that's it. That's another series. It's the road. It's the end of the road. Thanks to Logan also. Gotta shout Logan out every week.
Thanks to Logan.
For Sean Johnson, for Tim McIntosh and Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, happy reading.